Hello, this is Tom Campbell, host of a series of interviews with local musicians and music industry professionals from the 1950s, 60s, and 70s. Today's interview is with David Hursk of Gaiety Records. Today is January 21st, 2012, and I'm talking with David Hursk from Gaiety Records. David, what is your full name, your date of birth, and your hometown, please?
My name is David Hursk. I was born in Minneapolis, Minnesota on May 24th, 1939.
And what part of town did you grow up in, David?
North Minneapolis.
Where did you go to high school?
North High School.
And what year did you graduate?
1957.
At what year did you become interested in the recording business, and was there a certain event that got you interested in the recording process?
When I was 12 years old, my Hebrew teacher had recorded my bar mitzvah haftorah and the blessings on a Wilcox Gay recorder on some paper discs, and I was intrigued about it because that's how I learned my bar mitzvah lessons. Anyway, I got interested in the recording from just watching that and seeing that this might be something that had some interest to me.
What year would that have been?
That would have been 1951, roughly.
So what happened next?
Well, I became interested in recording, and I went with my dad to a music store that was on 7th and Hennepin, if I recall, and they had a Wilcox Gay Recordette, which was a single-arm recorder player. It had a radio in it, an AM radio. It recorded at 78 RPM. It was used, and he wanted $25 for it, and my dad got it for me, and that really was my start in the recording business.
And what kind of discs did that record on?
It recorded on acetates, which were either metal discs or paper records coated with an acetate coating.
And those would have been what size?
They would have been 6.5 inch, 8 inch, and if I recall, 10 inch was the biggest you could record on it.
And where did you buy these discs?
They were readily available. I mean, home recording at that time was fairly popular. Wilcox Gay was the main manufacturer of the Recordio and Recordette, and 78 RPM was the popular speed, although 45 and 33 were just starting to evolve.
Now, were these one-sided discs that would record, or could you record on both sides?
Some of them you could record on both sides, and some were single-sided.
So let me get this straight. The Recordette had a radio in it and a built-in microphone and also a disc recorder?
Yes. Basically what it was an AM radio and had a built-in microphone. It was a Shure microphone, actually, that was attached to it. There was also a jack for an auxiliary for a line-in where you could plug something else in. And it was a single arm because most recorders at the time were two arms. One arm was for cutting and another arm for playback. This had both. So to record with it, you lifted it up, which engaged the lead screw, which cut the record. And then to playback, you pushed the arm down and used it as a regular playback arm.
So was it possible then to record songs live off the radio?
Yes, that's basically what I did initially.
And you would have to do this live and time when the record would start and when it would end?
Yes. In fact, I remember one instance. There was a program on WMIN. It was Merle Edwards, if I remember. He had a request radio show, and it was at the time Bill Haley's Rock Around the Clock was very popular, and I wanted to get a copy of it, and I had called in, and then Merle mentioned, he said, David, start your recorder. And then he started the record, so I would have a few silent grooves before the song started.
Now, having a recordette at a young age like that, was this something unique, or did your friends have these also, or was it popular?
I think it was a popular machine. I don't know who else had one. I mean, it was kind of the means if you wanted to record music and stuff. This was probably that, or a Recordio was really the way to do it.
And then at some point you upgraded here to a different version?
Yes. At that time, a little bit later, 45 and 33 became very popular, and the one unit I had only did 78s. And I switched and picked up through the classified Recordette 3, which is basically the same configuration, the AM radio, the auxiliary, the built-in mic, only it was three speeds.
What was the cost on that, do you recall?
It was very inexpensive. It was around $75.
What year did you decide to set up your own recording business?
Basically, it was when I was a sophomore at North High School in 1955.
And what did you do to get your recording business up and running?
Well, my dad had worked at Honeywell at the time, and there was a gentleman there that had a MagnaCord PT6. And that was a full-track recorder and very popular at the time, and apparently the person wasn't using it, so he sold it for $65.
And what did it have for a microphone?
I picked up a dynamic, I think it was an Electro Voice dynamic microphone. Mm-hmm. That was fairly inexpensive, and used that as my main microphone.
Now, what types of groups did you start recording at this time period?
At that point, I really didn't have a studio, so it was basically remote things like quartets. Four freshmen were popular, and four lads, and four whatever, four aces. So there were a lot of foursomes at different high schools. And I did like high school plays, high school bands, high school concerts, things like that.
Was the recording equipment easy to move around?
Actually, the MagnaCorder was fairly heavy because it was a two-part unit. You had the mechanism on one part and you had the electronics on another part, so it wasn't that light.
So you're a sophomore. You're how old at this time?
16.
And how are you able to go to all these remote locations to record these different musical groups?
My parents took me.
Where did you set up the microphone generally?
Well, if I was doing a band or a choir, I usually put it in the middle, center of the group.
Mm-hmm. Any other places you recorded at?
Yes, MacPhail School of Music. I did most of their recitals and so forth and recorded there quite a bit.
So once you had these musical groups recorded live, what did you do with the tapes?
At that point in time, I offered them the opportunity to buy records of these, of their recital or of the concert and so forth. And at that point in time, I wasn't pressing records. I was basically cutting them individually on a disc recorder.
And what was the name of that disc recorder?
I had gone from, obviously, the Wilcox Gay. I had upped it to a RecoCut machine, and it was a RecoCut Challenger. And if I recall right, it was $495, and it cut at 33 or 78.
And this cuts records one at a time?
Yes.
And these are, would you call these acetates?
Yes, they were acetates.
Okay, so you would end up recording the bands and then selling them however many acetates they wanted to buy.
Correct.
So what year is it that you start talking to your parents about turning the basement of the family house into a recording studio?
This was in 1956 because at that time there were a lot of high school bands. I felt there was an opportunity because the main studio in town at that point in time was K Bank. Another gentleman called Lee Newman, which had a studio at the Time Building, he did recording, so I felt there was an opportunity, and they agreed to convert our basement into a recording studio.
They had no misgivings or...
No, because the basement wasn't, other than the laundry, there wasn't much down there.
Where was the family house located?
At 1501 Newton Avenue North.
So at some point here, you upgrade your equipment again. What's the next step up with your recording equipment?
Well, from the RecoCut, because it was very limited what you could do, I purchased a Presto 6N recorder, which was a very big step up because it had a spiraling crank so you could make bands between the songs and so forth. You could also change the lead screw so you have different pitches, different times that you could put on the records. And the other thing you could do with it is you could mount different cutting heads on it. The problem with the RecoCut is when you bought it for $495, you couldn't upgrade it or do anything to it. That was it. The 6N cut all three speeds, and I had put a Grampian Gotham cutting system on it, which was very nice at the time.
Where did you get that equipment?
Everything we got was a place called Hi-Fi Sound, which was on 12th and LaSalle.
And how about your tape recorder? Did that get upgraded also?
Right. From the MagnaCord, I went to an Ampex 350 monaural tape recorder.
Okay, so you graduate from North High School in what year?
1957.
And you have the basement finished into a recording studio?
Yes.
What kind of finishing did you have in the basement?
Had acoustic tile on the ceiling and knotty pine or knotty cedar on the walls. Not the best, and asphalt tile on the floor. So it wasn't ideal, but it worked out fine.
Did you build a control room?
Yes, there was a separate control room with a glass window.
So now you start bringing bands in to record for the first time in the basement, right?
Yes.
Do you recall the very first musical group that you recorded live at a remote location?
Yes. It was a group from Robbinsdale called the Quarter Notes. There were four of them.
Four singers?
Right, and a piano player.
All right, and as far as the basement studio now, do you recall the first band that came into your studio to record?
Yes, it was the Glen Rays.
The Glen Rays. Where were they from?
St. Paul.
Do you know who the musicians were or the leader of the band?
The leader was Richard Mullen and Jack Uttermark, Bill Hawley, and Jim Woods.
So the Glen Rays come into your basement studio, and do you recall the songs they recorded?
Yes, it was two original ones, Easy Rhythm and Haunted by Repetition.
What kind of style would you describe the Glen Rays as?
Well, their initial recording was similar to what Duane Eddy's Rebel Rouser was. They wanted to get that kind of a sound.
Instrumental?
Right.
And did you press up the 45s for them, or?
Yes, I had them, they were mastered and pressed by a company in New York called Shelley Products, and they were pressed via injection molding.
What kind of a deal did you offer the band as far as records and recording fee?
Basically, it was a three-hour session and 1,000 45s for $495.
So the Glen Rays come out on Gaiety. Now, I'm curious where the name Gaiety came from. Do you recall?
That's a good question. I honestly don't recall. The only thing, I always used to get kidded because there used to be, well, there was a burlesque house called the Elvin, but before that it was called the Gaiety. So people started relating to that. They said, is there any relationship to the old burlesque house? And I said, no.
In Minneapolis?
Yes.
Now, the Glen Rays have their 45 come out, and how did they distribute the record, or how did that work?
Basically, the way they distributed it was when they played live performances, they offered the record for sale there. We also tried to get some radio play on it and so forth. I remember going to some of the disc jockeys with them to Bill Deal and Dan Daniels and some of those people to see if we could get some airplay. But at that point in time, if you wanted to get airplay, most of the radio stations like KDWP or WDGY were all basically playing top 40 music. And if you wanted to get your record played, payola or pay for play was very, very popular back then.
So after the Glen Rays record, what other bands came in during this very early time period of the basement recording studio?
I did a couple groups from Robbinsdale. They were the Sonics and the Blue Cats. Well, basically, they were the same group. The difference was that they changed their name, but the people in the band were the same.
Oh, okay. And same thing, they pressed up 1,000?
Right. Everybody had the same deal, and I used Shelley Products to press up all my initial recordings.
So who would have been your competition at this time?
K-Bank.
Did they offer similar package deals to bands?
Yes, yes.
Okay.
In fact, I think the package they offered was basically the same package. The only difference was you could be on the Soma label, which was owned by Amos Heilitzer, and Soma had national distribution, so it was an opportunity for possibly for the group to be picked up on a national basis.
Now, K-Bank was not always at that Nicollet Avenue location, correct?
Correct.
Where were they originally?
They were originally what's called Film Row. Back in the day, they had film distributors. So each studio, like Columbia, Republic, Universal, each had a distribution branch. And if a theater wanted a movie, they would get it from the distributor at the time. And their studio was right in Film Row.
So you were familiar with the people at K-Bank?
Yes, because I remember when I was in junior high, we did a story or something like that for KUOM, and all the recordings for KUOM, which is the University of Minnesota radio station, were done at K-Bank, and I got a chance to go up there.
And who did you know at K-Bank?
I got a chance to meet Vern, and, well, actually, afterwards, I got to know them all. Vern, Jim Hotman, John Michelson, Tom Jung, basically everybody who worked there.
John Michelson and Tom Jung were engineers.
Yes.
And Vern was the owner.
Vern was the owner of the studio, yes.
And it was named after his
wife.
His wife, Kay. You told me once that originally was a movie theater.
Right, it was the Roxy Theater. And then Bruce Swedeen bought it and changed it into a recording studio called Swedeen Recording, and then Bank bought it after that. And Bruce Swedeen is very famous. He's on the West Coast.
So what is the next improvement to your recording equipment, and what time period?
Well, in 1958, I purchased a Neumann lathe, and again, that was purchased through Hi-Fi Sound, and that came from Gotham Audio in New York. And Gotham Audio was a distributor for Neumann and also for the Grampian Gotham stuff and a lot of professional equipment. I was the first one to get the lathe, and it was $2,850, and it had a lot of features to it that made it ideal for mastering.
That certainly seems like a lot of money for 1958.
Actually, it was.
So with the Neumann lathe, what does that do to improve your recording business?
Actually, it was a very good selling point. I could master on that, but I actually did cut masters with the 6N2 because I use the same cutting system, which is the Gotham Grampian cutting head on the 6N as well as on the Neumann. So basically, the Neumann was a big selling point.
So by cutting the masters, then you could take the master to get it pressed?
Yes, exactly.
And where did you go to get your records pressed?
I then started using the local pressing plant, which was owned by K-Bank.
Were there any issues with your parents or your neighbors having rock and roll bands playing in the basement?
No, the only thing is we said that we wouldn't record after 10 o'clock at night.
Did you advertise in the local newspapers at all?
No, most of my advertising was at that point in time was the yellow pages of the phone book.
So you did put Gaiety Records in there?
Right. And I had a couple articles in the newspaper of things I had recorded, and I also was on a radio program called Night Watch, which was on WDGY Radio at the time. It was an interview program similar to what we're doing here.
You mentioned a trip you made to K-Bank one day on a business trip, and you just happened to be there when Bobby V from Fargo, North Dakota, was recording Susie Baby for Soma. Tell us a little bit about that.
Basically, I had stopped in there. I'm not sure why I stopped in there, but I was there. Bobby V was there with his group, which was the Shadows at the time. I think he was about 16, if I recall, and he was recording Susie Baby, and John Michelson was the engineer on it and sat in on part of the session.
Did you think it might turn out to be a hit song for Bobby V? I
had no idea.
Is there anything before 1962 you want to get in here?
One of the recordings I did with the Robbinsdale Choir was I had met a newscaster from KDWB at the time, and his name is Dan Ronald. He was 17 years old, and we had done a Christmas record with him called Silent Night and Little Drummer Boy, and had licensed that to Kuka Records. Kuka was a client of K-Bank, and they were based in Wisconsin. So he took the master and released it.
Kuka Records, I believe, had the first 45 of the Fendermen.
I don't recall, but that was interesting because this young newscaster had a voice that was just unbelievable.
Were all the bands that recorded at Gaiety from the Twin Cities area, or were there any from outside the Twin Cities?
Yes, a number of groups came from other parts of the country, and a couple groups had come from North Dakota. Curtis and the Galaxy had come in 1959, and then they recommended to another band, Howie Butler and the Reflections, also from North Dakota, in September. They recorded at my place.
So how would they have found out in North Dakota that you had a recording studio?
I would guess that they probably checked the Twin Cities for recording studios, because I think at that point in time, I was not familiar with any studios in Fargo.
Do you recall what songs Curtis and the Galaxies recorded?
Yes, they recorded Laura Lee and Theme from a Fireplace. Both of them were originals.
And do you recall what songs Howie Butler and the Reflections recorded?
Yes, they recorded Treasure of Love, which was a very popular song by Clyde McFadder at the time, and then an original called Have a Good Time.
And that, I believe, was written by Howie Butler.
Yes.
David, did the location of the recording studio change at any time, or was it always in the basement of the family house?
Well, basically, I had an opportunity to become a sound engineer at Empire Photo Sound, which was a industrial film production company. They were located right on Lindale and Franklin. They asked if I wanted to set up my studio there in exchange for helping them as a sound engineer, and they had a nice basement studio in their basement of their building that was all soundproof, very professional and so forth. So I moved all my equipment there and my lathe.
So you're working for Empire Photo Sound during the day and then recording bands evenings and weekends?
Yes, but I didn't do that much live recording there because I was really busy doing their work with them.
What bands did you record at Empire Photo Sound?
The one that comes to my mind is the Yeomen.
Who were the Yeomen and where were they from?
The Yeomen were from Edina High School. They were juniors and seniors, and the group was made up of Jack Otterness, who played guitar, Keith Critchlow, who played banjo, Don Bennett, who did a stand-up bass, and Bob Finkenauer, who did guitar. And a little background is I was involved with Junior Achievement at that point in time. I was an advisor, or Gady was an advisor to the company. We had started a record company, which was a first for Junior Achievement. And the president of our company was Keith Critchlow, and he is the one suggested that their folk group should be what we would make the record out of. And that's how the Yeomen came to be the first thing I recorded at Empire Photo Sound.
And that was actually pressed up as an album.
Yes, it was. It was called Session One.
I've seen the album. It has a very high-quality color photo on it of the band. It looks like they're near a local lake or park.
Right. It was taken at Lake of the Isles.
Mm-hmm. And so that is released on High Top Records.
Right. And that was our initial release. And the record was pressed, actually, not by K-Bank. It was pressed by Columbia Records, or Columbia's pressing plant in Terre Haute, Indiana.
Now, this is a folk band, correct?
Yes. It was the time when folk music was very, very popular.
What happened with their album?
They had sold it where they sang and so forth, and one of the things we were able to do because of the Junior Achievement connection, we licensed it to Mercury Records.
For a national release?
Yes.
And did they have any success on a national level?
Very minor.
What else came out on the High Top label?
We did a 45 with a group called the West Winds, which was another folk group.
So who was in the West Winds and where were they from?
The West Winds were from Robbinsdale. They were all seniors, and the people in the group were Bob Simpson, Tom Johnson, Jerry Roulette, and Sheldon Sizer. The title of the 45 was, one of the songs was Cotton Mill Girls.
A standard folk song?
Yes, yes. In fact, what's interesting with that is I had sent it into Cameo Parkway, which was a fairly big label at that point, and they had a group called the Highwaymen, and their first release was Michael Row the Boat Ashore, which is a religious song or something like that. Anyway, next thing I knew, because Cameo said we're not interested, is the Highwaymen came out with Cotton Mill Girls.
Really?
Yes.
And they had a hit with it.
Yes.
One thing I haven't asked you so far is, did you go out yourself and see local bands play live?
Not really.
Mm-hmm.
I saw some of the groups that I had recorded live, mm-hmm. but I wasn't that interested in going out to see them, see new bands.
What happens to High Top Records?
Well, basically, it was a junior achievement company, and it was quite profitable, and we tried to set up a second company the following year, and Junior Achievement National, JA, said that the company was too profitable to consider for junior achievement anymore. He said you were actually a business.
In other words, you were told you were making too much money.
Yes.